morning is number 053963, United States against Stevens.
Thank you, Your Honor. May it please the court, Bill Dacey, Indiana Federal Community Defenders. The court has now heard from three-fourths of our office this morning, and we're hopeful nothing important is happening in Indianapolis today. I represented Mr. Stevens at trial and continue as his appointed counsel on appeal. Mr. Stevens was charged with three counts of being a felon in possession of firearms and ammunition. He went to trial, was acquitted of a count charging that he possessed bullets, which police officers claimed to retrieve from his pocket. He was acquitted, or he was convicted of two weapons recovered from a truck in which Mr. Stevens was a passenger. We raised with the court sufficiency of the evidence arguments as to the weapons that he was convicted, and Almendarez Torres argument as to the application of the armed career criminal statute to his case. I would suggest that the sufficiency of the evidence arguments are somewhat different than most cases involving a vehicle stop and guns or drugs recovered from the vehicle because the police had been under surveillance of the vehicle prior to the stop and had some clue as to what had been going on. As the court may have noted, the police officers were watching Mr. Stevens' brother's house because he had a parole violation warrant out. They observed a drunken Ralph Downing leave the truck, walk into the house, exit the house with two shotguns, two long weapons, place one bed of the truck, get into a, as you just crowded cab of the truck with two other individuals with the shotgun. The government's witness, Gary Stevens, who was Mr. Stevens' brother, testified that Ralph had been in the house. Ralph had been waving a pistol around, that he, Gary, expected to be taken to the pawn shop to pawn his two long weapons, two shotguns, and that Ralph just sort of staggered off with his weapons, and they all drove away. We argue, I would desperately like the acquittal of the count involving the bullets taken from his pocket to mean something with reference to the sufficiency arguments here, but it doesn't, of course. Other than perhaps
A discriminating jury.
They were rational when they took that action. I argue that they were irrational when they convicted my client of the other two weapons. And so, you know, I say this with reference to the shotguns. My suggestion is that the evidence is insufficient to conclude that my client had some requisite intention under a constructive possession argument to exert control. That is, the person the police, who, by the way, was a convicted felon and wasn't charged, the person the police knew brought the shotgun to the truck and placed it into the truck, to conclude that Mr. Stevens, from the fact that it was in the truck, had the requisite intention to exercise control over that shotgun. I would argue the evidence was insufficient to support that. The police know by the time they walk up to the truck, the vehicle, or that the shotgun is pointed toward the floorboard, the stock of the weapon is pointed toward the door, and it's effectively at Mr. Stevens' lap. But again, would argue in the context of the entire case and what the police observed, that basing that conclusion, like some game of musical chairs, in what position the weapon happened to be at the time the police walked up to the truck is insufficient for a rational juror to base a conviction as to the shotgun.
Was that shotgun legal?
So far as we know, yes.
Wasn't a pistol handled shotgun?
No, so far as we know, they were both, they were both legal. It seems to me one of the two shotguns was a pistol grip type shotgun, but a lawful weapon. I think that was the one in front of Ben. The pistol, of course, as I have to acknowledge, the jury was free to believe or disbelieve Brother Gary's testimony that Ralph was waving this thing around in the basement before he left the house and entered the car. But from the perspective of evidence before the jury from which they could conclude that my client, again, exerted some requisite intention to exert control over this pistol as it was found under the seat in which he was sitting. It was the testimony of the officer in some kind of a precarious position. And his view expressed in several different ways, but the thrust of it was that the pistol should have fallen over while the vehicle was in motion from the way he observed the pistol. And further, as he approached the truck, he testified that Mr. Stevens ducked as the police approached. We've cited cases, and one would argue, that that kind of action is points to many possibilities, and that it isn't something upon which some conclusion of constructive possession could or should be lawfully based. But what is a problem, of course, I can point to the fact that the allegation is that he possessed that gun on that day and that he had a bullet. If the jury concluded that he had a bullet in his pocket that could have been fired from that weapon, then it doesn't go toward the basis for concluding that he possessed the weapon on the day that he was charged.
Was that weapon loaded?
Pardon me?
Was that weapon loaded?
It was. It had 15 rounds in the clip. I spent a lot of time beating up on that poor policeman in terms of where this other 16th bullet came from. But it did have 15 in the clip.
Normally could have one in the chamber.
It could have one in the chamber. His testimony was, when asked if it had one in the chamber, his testimony was, I don't think so. And Mr. Stevens, of course, testified that he watched the officer eject one that bounced off the hood of the car, and then he put it in his pocket. And that's if the verdicts weren't necessarily inconsistent. But in fact, there's nothing inconsistent about the verdicts. But with, I guess, point to the inherent incredible nature of the officer's testimony, as I did in the Rule 25 motions, and asked the court to conclude that the evidence viewed in the light most favorable to the government was insufficient for a rational juror to conclude my client possessed either weapon.
Who did you say was a criminal? Who was convicted criminal? Which of the other two?
Ralph Downing.
Downing carried the guns out of the house?
Yes, sir. As the court knows, both were called as witnesses and both professed no memory at all of those incidences. They decided they drank all day and just didn't remember being at Gary Stevens' house at all.
Was there blood alcohol on both the driver and the other passenger?
There was. There's no evidence of what it was. The driver, Donnie, had fled to drunk driving, and the passenger, Ralph, pled guilty of the intoxication. I don't know what alcohol was. They of course testified as to massive amounts of alcohol that shoot that day. So perhaps the lack of memory was understandable. With the court's leave, I'd like to take a little more time than perhaps it deserves to comment on the Almendarez-Torres claim. There are some unique factors in this case. Obviously, the issues raised on the possibility that lightning may strike this term, and the Supreme Court may take another look at the principles of Almendarez-Torres, and I hate to be the guy that waived that issue for Mr. Stevens if it does. But I'd ask the court to consider in this case that if it's true that there's no right to grand jury indictment as to facts of prior conviction that would raise the otherwise applicable statutory maximum sentence, which of course prior convictions do in this case, then it didn't matter whether or not the grand jury indicted and accused Mr. Stevens of being subject to application of the Armed Career Criminal Statute, yet they did. The indictment alleges not only the 922G firearm and ammunition counts, it alleges applicability of 924E, the Armed Career Criminal Statute, and indicted and alleged for four prior convictions, three of which are considered categorically violent felonies. But those three did not arise on occasions different than one another, as required under 924E. So we raised, and I raised by Rule 29 motion, and again in sentencing, the notion to preserve the Almendarez-Torres issue. But I suggest this, what this court has to say on these kinds of issues, even in losing efforts, is important, and it is terribly important to the marketplace of ideas and as these concepts develop in the law. And I ask the court to consider this. Is it a no-brainer that a grand jury, the citizens, given the job of being a barrier between an accusation of a crime and having to face that crime, is it a no-brainer that that grand jury would have decided that it's fair to charge a fourth prior violent felony, where that fourth felony was a nonviolent walk-away escape conviction for an offense committed when Mr. Stevens was 17 years old? And I suggest it isn't a no-brainer. If a grand jury had the opportunity to make those considerations, it isn't, as the government would argue, clear just irrelevant that that these convictions weren't submitted to a federal grand jury. I suggest that it is relevant because of that historic moment. I would further suggest, because Mr. Stevens didn't deny it, the existence of these convictions at sentencing, it doesn't mean the government could have proven those convictions to a jury by a standard proof beyond a reasonable doubt. That's just the court's sequence in the last year. And so the clock on the clubhouse wall. So if you sit down, I shall. It's been an honor.
Thank you, Mr. Stevens. You're now, Mr. Hanson.
Good morning. Please, the court. My name is James Hanlon. I'm Assistant U.S. Attorney. I represent the government in this case. I'd like to begin by responding to one or two of the questions that have been raised by the panel. Just a couple of clarifying points. First of all, the shotgun that was in the cab of the truck was in fact a pistol grip shotgun, which did not make it, however, an illegal weapon per se. That has to do with the length of the barrel. If there's no
barrel, it's not the overall length of the weapon.
Your Honor, I believe that it is actually the overall length, but that was never an issue in this case, and there is no allegation.
The stock was cut off, and it's just a pistol grip left.
That's correct, Your Honor. That's correct. Secondly, as far as the issue of the number of rounds that the 9mm pistol can hold, it does, in fact, as already pointed out by the court, it can hold 16 rounds in the chamber while the magazine is already filled with 15 rounds. And in fact, Special Agent Jason Tortorizzi, the ATF, at the trial, and this is at page 112 of volume 1 of the transcript, testified that he, in fact, did a test in the course of his investigation. He was able to put 15 rounds in the magazine and then load a 16th round in the chamber. So that was evidence that was before the jury in this case. As far as the overall sufficiency of the evidence is concerned, what it really boils down to is whether there's sufficient evidence for the jury to find a nexus between the defendant and the weapons that he was found guilty of convicting. That really was the crux of the analysis here. And of course, this court must view the facts in the light most favorable to the government in this context and affirm the guilty verdict as long as it could have been found by any rational jury. As far as the...
When the officer reached in and grabbed the, what was this pistol grip shotgun, where was it? Between the legs of the...
Yes, Your Honor. The testimony at trial was that the barrel of the gun was pointed down into the floorboard directly below where Mr. Stevens was seated, and that the pistol grip was actually in between Mr. Stevens' legs in his crotch area. So as far as the overall nexus linking Mr. Stevens to the shotgun, we have first the physical location of that gun, that it was in fact in between Mr. Stevens'
legs. Intimate relationship with the shotgun at that time.
Yes, Your Honor, that's correct. That's correct. And we also have, beyond that, contrary to what Daisy has suggested, there are additional facts linking Jeff Stevens to that shotgun. Most notably are the facts that the house that Downing walked out of carrying the shotgun is Jeff Stevens' brother's house. And the facts of trial show that Gary Stevens, who is Jeff Stevens' brother, testified that he and Jeff had discussed 10 to 15 times their plan to have them both go to the pawn shop, that Jeff was going to go with Gary to pawn his two shotguns. So from that, we know that Jeff Stevens knew the two shotguns were in the house, and in fact, from the record, we know that Jeff Stevens had been over at Gary Stevens' house earlier that very same day. Now, contrary, the record shows that Ralph Downing, the guy who carried the shotgun out of the house, testified at trial that he didn't even know Gary Stevens. And Gary Stevens, similarly, testified that he only knew Ralph Downing by his first name. So I think that when we look at all these factors and what makes sense, what adds up, is we get a picture where even though Downing is the one who carried the gun out of the house, that Jeff Stevens was the one orchestrating this, and that the jury could certainly rationally have concluded from the evidence in this case that Jeff Stevens directed these guys to let's go over to my brother's house, Ralph, go inside, get that gun, and carry it out. And of course, possession can be proven through substantial evidence, and possession actually can be through another person as well. So
the possession doesn't take a lot, and obviously if you sit there for a shotgun, and they discern that he has to put it under the seat. The curiosity I have is that Gary fully expected to make the trip. Where was he going to fit in that truck? Going to get the back?
That's a good question.
Well, then somebody would have to have been displaced. Now, you think it wouldn't have been just me?
That's a good question.
I was just curious because that was the whole... First, people showed up, I guess, these gals who wanted guns in the car, and well, they weren't going to drive.
That's correct.
So, whatever the facts are, that's what they are. But it was interesting to see they all came out of the house.
It is rather strange, and in fact, Gary Stevens at trial testified when he was asked, didn't he run out of the house, or was he worried when Ralph, this guy he barely knew, left with his guns? He said, oh no, because I knew that my brother was in the truck. So again, we have a very strong link between Stevens and the shotgun. As far as the pistol is concerned, they have the physical location of the gun. It was directly under the seat where Jeff Stevens was sitting. It was balanced in a somewhat odd fashion, suggesting that it had recently been put under the seat. We have the testimony of the officers that Jeff Stevens was seen bending over, suggesting that he was the one who, in fact, put that pistol under that seat. We also have both of the co-occupants of the truck denied any knowledge of that gun. And very importantly also, we have Mr. Stevens' the fact that the 9mm round of ammunition that was found in his pocket, which is what the officer testified to, that was the same type of ammunition that was recovered out of the 9mm pistol on that day.
For some reason, we didn't prosecute Allen. Felon in possession when the officer sees him carrying guns out of the house?
He could have been. Your Honor, there's no other than a judgment was made not to charge him. And also, I think a very important fact that the court should evaluate in the context of sufficiency of the evidence for both guns is the fact that Stevens falsely identified himself. And the government has cited authorities in its brief standing for the proposition that a jury certainly may draw inferences of guilt and of knowledge flowing out of a defendant falsely identifying himself. Moving on to the issue of the use of the judicial fact-finding with prior felony convictions that were used to enhance the sentence, I would note that Almendarez-Torres involved a situation where the sentencing enhancement provision 8 U.S.C. 1326b2 was not presented to the grand jury. The defendant, in fact, in that case, I don't think he was given any notice that he could even be eligible for this greatly enhanced sentence. Nonetheless, the rule flowing from that case is that that prior conviction does not have to be charged and may be used to enhance a sentence. And I think perhaps most significantly here, we have the case cited in the government's brief, which I think is a good encapsulation of where we stand right now as far as jurisprudence in this area, and that's the case of the United States versus Williams, where this court very recently affirmed the very principle that the district court does not violate the defendant's Sixth Amendment right to a jury trial by making findings regarding his criminal record that exposes the greater criminal penalty. And this court in that case specifically observed and went through and said Apprendi, Blakely, Booker, and Shepard all acknowledge that the continuing validity of the rule of Almendarez-Torres as of this date. And if the panel has no further questions, for the reasons set forth in the government's brief and argued here this morning, the government would respectfully request that this court affirm the judgment of the court below. Thank you.
Thank you, Mr. Hanlon. Mr. Day, do you have any time left? Well, in that case, the case will be taken under advisement with our thanks to both counsel. This concludes the calendar of the day. And I would like to take just a moment point out that there is an ancient tradition of the legal profession of this country that judges should participate in legal education. And today, we, by being here at Notre Dame, have had the opportunity to continue that tradition. So I think the court really should thank, before we rise, Dean O'Hara, Associate Dean Nagel, faculty and students of the University of Notre Dame for their very warm hospitality and congratulations, hospitality and cooperation in putting on this session of the court today. I should also like to thank especially the ladies and gentlemen from campus security at Notre Dame who have assisted our own marshals and court security officers in fulfilling their obligations. And finally, I'd like to thank counsel for going the extra step with us today to a different ambiance than you usually find yourselves in so that the students could learn from your many years of accumulated experience. It indeed is a very valuable asset for them to have. So with those remarks, the court will rise until the next hearing.